Damn, it's hot out here.
Huh. Well, I'm underneath this tent. Alright, Twitter. Alright, at Iowa Speedway today. Pretty damn hot. Clouds, please come soon. Thanks. Hashtag Iowa300. Hashtag IndyCar. Okay. Oh, sweet, it's cool. Oh, there's clouds. Oh, no. Oh, crap. Damn. Welcome to the worst motorsports weather predictions in the history of the world. Motorsport 101.
Chris's manipulation over the weather is so powerful that he has put Ryan Eric King underwater. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's the wrong New York neighborhood. My apologies.
Though, I do have to mention, looking out my window, there's a big, dark, ominous cloud.
Oh, my God.
And I did get a text alert saying that right now there is a flash flood warning, so...
All this and you're still in the middle of a heat wave. What the fuck? Welcome to Motorsport 101. Filling in for your friendly neighborhood host, Andre Harrison. I am RJ O'Connell. As you might have guessed, Ryan Eric King and Christopher DeHardy are here. First, King, hello.
Hello.
I'm glad you're not underwater.
Yes, unfortunately, South Brooklyn hosted an E-Pri. Week later, underwater. Coincidence? I think not. But also, I'm fine. The Bronx wasn't hit as hard as Brooklyn. But that dark, ominous cloud, give me worries.
Apparently, it's extending all the way up through the Northeast. It's like northeastern weather. If you can't handle me at my worst, you don't deserve me at my also worst.
There is not a best. Sorry.
There really is not the best. Chris, Chris, back from Iowa Speedway, having taken control over the HARP weather manipulation systems, how are you this afternoon?
Better today. I'm off of work. 2 days from recording this, I'm going to be driving to Mid-Ohio Sports Car Course, so the pursuit never ends. It just doesn't end.
I'm gonna say as well, because I had listened to this while I was doing yard work. I've listened back to the Iowa 300 broadcast, and we'll get into the race in a bit. But I gotta say though, just be glad you weren't at James Hinchcliffe's barbecue, where he accidentally tried to hit Alexander Rossi with that medium rare chicken.
Yeah, I was busy trying to avoid the rainstorm. Would you like to hear the story about that?
Oh, please, yes.
So I was busy finishing up some other business I was handling, and I had parked my car right outside of turn number 4, and I was getting ready. I was getting onto a tram that was going to take me all the way to turn 4, or so I thought. Then the tram was going towards turn 4. Then rain just started to absolutely pour down on us, and in between the outside of the track between the start finish line and turn number 1. The tram driver said, "I'm sorry, I can't go any further." So I had to run all the way from there, all the way around the parking lots on the far side of the track, on the outside of the track, to get to my car, get inside of the car, and then just cool off. And then that's when I happened to message everybody in Discord, and that's when we figured out what the episode title was going to be for this one.
Hashtag blame DeHardy. We are going to talk all about the Iowa Speedway, Iowa 300, which I always want to call the Iowa Corn 300, because no matter if Iowa Corn is actually sponsoring the event, corn is still all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-eternal in the state of Iowa. There were also other races that happened, including a W Series doubleheader in Assen in the Netherlands, including the first ever running of what we affectionately refer to as the Jamie Chadwick Non-Invitational Trophy, with a finish that went down to just 3/100ths of a second.
Oof.
Yes. And with that, we also have some updates on IMSA from Lime Rock Park. Formula E silly season kicking off with a major driver announcement from the reigning team's championships the reigning team's champions is Andre Lotterer is switching seats to the new Porsche Formula E team. And we'll talk about that and its implications. IndyCar driver news, plus a look to a stacked weekend ahead, which has the F1 German Grand Prix, that IndyCar Grand Prix of Mid-Ohio, the 24 hours of Spa-Francorchamps, and the Suzuka 8 hours, all on this jam-packed episode of Motorsport 101. Places you can find us, we are at youtube.com/Motorsport101, facebook.com/Motorsport101. Our Twitter is at Motorsport_101, and if you wish to follow us personally, you can at Harrison101HD, at Ryan Eric King, that's with 2 K's, Stuart, at RJ O'Connell, and at C. DeHardy. And of course, with your financial support at patreon.com/Motorsport101, you help make this podcast what it is today. For better and for worse. For $5, you get early access to every show we record. And for $10, you can get in the supporter section of our Discord channel and listen to each show as it's being recorded. And also share hideous engine swap concepts before the recording, including a Chevrolet LS swapped Yugo.
Man, how do we explain this to new people who want to join this Discord server?
Some people have way too much money. That's it.
Remember, it's the Motorsport 101 supporter section, your official home for Pontiac Aztecs with Lamborghini doors. Yes.
This is like a West Coast Customs reject.
Yo, Zibit heard you like cars, so he put a car inside of a car inside of your tent. Anyway, enough of the dead memes. Motorsport101.com, where you can find all of our written and podcast works. So this is going to be a jam-packed show. But before we get into Iowa, let's check it back a little bit. Let's have ourselves a little throwback. Because, something very important happened around this same day, a pretty long time ago. King, why don't you hit him with that first ever automobile race?
Oh, well, you gotta take yourselves back to August 22nd. I mean, July 22nd. Wow. You got to take yourself back to July 22nd, 1895, in an event that took months of planning and a whole bunch of shenanigans to actually organize.
Yes.
That they were able to complete an 126-kilometer race from Paris, France, to Rouen, France, in Normandy, and they completed the entire distance. Surprisingly, most of the front runners completed the distance under 7 hours. 7 hours on the road. There was a mandatory stop at midway, and the margin of victory was only 5 minutes.
This is Le Petit Journal Horseless Carriages Contest from Paris to Rouen, held around the same time in 1894. It is the 125th anniversary of this 78-mile, 126-kilometer road race from Paris to Rouen. 102 entered, and yeah, this was a trip, as Ryan chronicled in his long, lengthy, and very informative Twitter thread in the days up to this recording, King. So, my goodness, so tell me just a sort of attrition that we had in this first ever automobile race.
So, I think I kind of glossed over it. I never really talked about it in detail, but qualifying for this event happened the week before. That's where you see the number of entrants being 102. Yeah, qualifying was a 10. So only 21 people qualified from 102.
Golly, and you thought Indianapolis 500 bump day was intense. You thought the Gatorade duels at Daytona were intense.
So, I don't know the exact number of people actually showed up to qualifying. So the way qualifying worked, it was effectively group qualifying. They broke up people into groups. You had a mini loop around, you know, around the outskirts of Paris. Complete the loop, you get to qualify. Don't complete the loop, you don't get to go to the show. But there were numerous no-shows of people who just, for one reason or another, couldn't make qualifying. Notably, Benz wanted to enter two cars. I don't know who their drivers were going to be, because at the time, France did not like Germany a lot, so on the entry list, they were just listed as Deutsch and Deutsch, which, like, just listed on the entry list as German and German. I'm like, guys, you can't do this.
Oh, geez, that's going to be what happens if, like, Mercedes withdraws their likeness from the F1 games and they have to go full Pomonte Calcio. They're just going to be called Deutsch and Deutsch F1 team.
Another notable no-show was the only prominent electric car entered in the event from a British company based in Birmingham. Let me pull up their exact name.
Oh, it's not coming home for Gerard and Blumfield.
Yeah, Gerard
missing and qualifying despite paying the entry fee, but we don't know why they missed the show.
So eventually I flipped through to later issues of Le Petit Journal, and one of the owners of the company, C.R. Gerard, sent in an open letter to be published in the newspaper, and he said the reason why they couldn't attend qualifying was they had only built one electric car, and between the point where they formally entered the race and qualifying, they had sold their only car and didn't have enough time to build a second one. But
oh my god, what was the response to this though? This is where it gets wild.
This is where it gets wild. They had only built one car. They didn't have enough time to build a second one. So they asked the owner of the one they sold, could they borrow it to bring to Paris to compete in this event? The owner declined. And in this open letter, Gerard pretty much says, readers, you could take up your grievances with the owner. Here is the owner's name and address.
He got them.
And I'm like, why?
Oh my goodness. Yes. It was a very interesting route taking us from Portmayeau in Paris all the way from Mont-la-Jolie. Did I have that right? Mont-la-Jolie?
Yeah, so...
Mont-la-Jolie.
So, Montes, I think it's Mont-la-Jolie, and then it finishes at on the outskirts of Rouen, which is like, there's like that. We're close enough. We don't want to race into the middle of a crowded city. That wouldn't be a good look for all of us.
No, and of course, the winner of the 1894... Le Petit Le Journal Horseless Carriages Challenge would be awarded a prize of
5,000 francs, which...
What is that in American... What is that in today's money?
I need to actually do the estimate. So at the time, the franc was on the gold standard, and it was worth about 1.45 kilograms of gold. So you could pretty much just look up the price of gold, input that number, and you would actually just get, you know, you would get how much it would be worth today.
All right. But of course, after all of this trekking, we have controversy. Controversy in the first ever automobile race king.
Was it BOP?
It was not BOP, unfortunately. So the first driver across the line was Jules Albert, the Comte de Dedans, or just they just called him Jules Albert de Dedans. Dedans had his own steam carriage company. He built steam carriages, thought it was to be good promotion for his race. I mean, good promotion for his company by competing in the race. He had experience because a few years prior, he had organized his own motor race event. And there's from Paris to Versailles, and there's one particular reason why that is not the first motor racing event, because he was the only entrant. So he completed the run, but he was the only competitor, so it wasn't really a race.
Also, I'm looking at this illustration of what I believe is the Comte de Dedans from 1899. I gotta tell you, with that mustache, this man fucks. This man absolutely fucks.
So, his steam carriage ended up being the fastest on the day. He didn't make midway. He wasn't first at midway, but during the second stage, he overtook for the lead and was first to arrive.
Stage breaks.
Well, you know, the roads were rough. They wanted to stop for lunch. They got their lunch.
Were there playoff points?
There were unfortunately not playoff points, as Dedans quickly realized.
Yeah, and no, don't worry. His bronze driver did not have to worry about meeting a minimum drive time. So Comte de Dedans, he's finished first. He's the winner, right?
Ooh, so the regulations are very vague for this event. Part in the regulation that states that the vehicle must be "quote unquote" easy to use, because the event organizers intended to advertise, you know, personal motorized travel. There was one issue that the judges found with the Dedans steam carriage, that it required someone to tend the fire for the steam boiler. Like, if you've ever seen, like, one of those, like, old steam locomotives, you see, you know, some dude shoveling coal into a fire. Well, this car required someone to put coal into the fire to heat the boiler. So the judges ruled it was not easy to use, since it required a second person for it to go. So he got disqualified.
And thus, despite finishing on track first, he was disqualified. And the next man to finish was...
Ooh, the next man to finish ended up being Albert Lemaître, who he was fast on the road. He was first at the midpoint. He had speed all day. But, you know, he wasn't first across the line.
And what kind of carriage was he driving?
He was driving a Peugeot.
Ah, yes. Why does that name sound familiar? And why does it sound familiar in the context of having overwhelming pace, but ultimately not getting the job done and finishing first on track?
So... as a little bit of background, Peugeot had by far the largest team in the field. They had entered, out of the 21 cars that qualified, they had 5 of them. Part of me wants to believe it was to make up for the first ever race Le Petit Journal held, which was a bicycle race from Paris all the way out to the most northwestern point of France in Bresque in Brittany and back in a bicycle race. Peugeot had asked the newspaper could they enter one of their cars in the race. The newspaper obliged, let them enter their car. Their car finished 6 days behind.
I was about to say, if this was the Tour de France that they had tried to enter, like, if you look into the history, especially of the first Tour de France and the subterfuge that went on to deciding that race, dog, I don't know what having a car in that would have done.
So, the car they entered, the Peugeot Type 3 in the bike race, was very slow. It was unreliable. And Peugeot, if you, you also need to remember, Peugeot is also a bicycle manufacturer. That's why they were allowed to run, because they also had entered bicycles into the same race.
So this is where they got the inspiration for the 98 Prost Peugeot. I gotcha.
So they reached Bresc, you know, the midway point of the race, the same day the winners of the bike race made it back to Paris.
Oh, God. But a much better time out here in the Paris Rouen. Is that correct?
Yes, much better timeout. Their latest edition, the Peugeot Type 7, produced almost twice as much horsepower as the previous car. They were the best, you know, petrol-powered car on the road. Like, besides Lemaitre finishing second, they had drivers, their other drivers finished third, fifth, third, fifth, ninth, and 11th. Their 11th place driver was driving an older model, but he was still like midfield, which is very impressive.
Right. And so through all of this, we're down to just two contenders. We have the man who finished first on the road, the Comte de Dion, but the man who has not yet been awarded the victory, because he was the first to finish, but in an ineligibly of vehicle, or Albert Lemaitre, the first to finish without getting disqualified. Who's going to take it? Who's going to claim the 5,000 franc prize?
So, reading, you know, retrospectives of the event from people who competed in it, apparently, well, Dedan still, he held a grudge for life against Pierre Giffard, the editor of the newspaper, for what had happened. Because Dedan feels like the newspaper was biased against steam-powered cars. They wanted they wanted a gas car to win. And Dedan was not awarded the victory.
Also our first equivalent of technology controversy.
Yes,
I see.
It is.
Decades, centuries before the WEC pulled it off.
Yes, it is. Because we ended up in a strange situation where we only ended up with steam and petrol-powered cars in the race. We could have ended up with an electric car in the race. I highly doubt it would have been able to make the finish. Also, other weird qualifiers. Bunch of people try to qualify gravity-powered cars, which, like, the modern equivalent...
That's just a soapbox car! That's just a soapbox derby car!
Yeah, it's just a soapbox car. Don't know how you're making it to the finish. For obvious reasons, most of them no-showed qualifying, because they knew what they had, and they knew they weren't gonna make it.
Like, I've played Gran Turismo 4 enough to know that those one-horsepower carriages aren't even making it up, like, a hill with, like, a 1% grade. A gravity-powered car is not gonna win a race like that.
So, yeah, there were 9 gravity-powered cars entered, all of them no-showed, 5 compressed air cars, which could work. You would need a massive tank of compressed air, but it could work. There were 2 cars powered by hydraulics, so they basically, like, let's just pump like fluid through a motor and, you know, maybe it'll go. But there was, I wouldn't say there was a bias, but the newspaper, you know, they knew that they built up Dedan as being someone who, if they framed the story in a way, if one of these petrol powered cars could beat Dedan, they could do anything. Like, they set Dedan up to be the first loser. Unfortunately, he did not lose.
Whoops. He finished first, but his car was ineligible, but he still finished first. Does he still take the Paris Rouen horseless carriage challenge?
Oh, he does not. They ended up, I don't know why, he got disqualified from winning first prize, but they gave him second place, which, guys, that's not how disqualifications work.
That's just a, you can just apply that as a post-race time penalty nowadays.
Yeah, it was like the finishing time was, his finishing time was 6 hours, 48 minutes. Like, he only won by five, like, he only won by
3 minutes because, Lemaitre was a 6 hour 51.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the second part of the, they waited at the midway point for everyone to arrive, then 90 minutes, and they went off again. So, yeah, the aggregate time only ended up being 3 minutes. So, it's like, they could have found another way. They're gonna be like, hey, time penalty for ineligible car, but no, we're disqualifying you from winning the main prize. You're just getting the second prize, which...
Right. And of course, all this you would have known, by the way, if you had checked the Mercedes-AMG Twitter account trying to spoil the whole festivities, yeah. Ruin the moment.
So the way I live tweeted it was pretty much as it would have happened in real time. And then I think during their approach to the finish, Mercedes was like, well... Guys, we won the first ever motor race 125 years ago. Well, we didn't win. We supplied the motor. But, you know, we won it, though.
Yeah, didn't y'all withdraw anyway?
Yeah, so...
Did y'all not qualify?
So, I know the five Peugeots in the race and the four Panhards in the race were all powered by Daimler motors. So they made up most of the field. The only car in the field that didn't have a Daimler gas motor was the Benz. Because the Benz ran a Benz motor.
So it's all Daimler customer engines at the front of the grid. Oh, Christ. It's like 2014 F1 all over again. Someone called that idiot from Forbes.
And then, I don't know why the judges felt this way, but they, obviously, they're not awarding 5,000 franc to a single driver. They award it to the manufacturer. But, they decided to split the prize between Peugeot and Panhard, which I find strange, but they found this perfectly normal. I'm pretty sure Panhard was happy to get half the first prize despite their best car finishing fourth.
Yeah, this is a large chunk of change, by the way.
Yeah, I think...
This ain't no small pennies.
So, in today's money, just on, like, the raw price of gold, the total amount for first prize was just under $66,500.
Okay, that's less money than I would have expected, but I mean, hey, that's more than a non-charter NASCAR entry gets paid for during a cup race. I gotta ask, and I know, Chris, you've been listening in, you have any spicy takes about this very first automobile race?
Ooh, spicy takes. Well, my spicy take is that Daydon should have won. I understand why they didn't want him to win. It would have been bad for the French automotive industry if Daydon won. But like, Daydon was very scorned. He ended up co-founding the Automobile Club de France, which the Automobile Club de France ran international motorsport up until the early 20s, and they pretty much the ACF co-founded the FIA and ran the FIA. So if Daydon would have won, it's very easy to say that the FIA would be a completely different body than it is today.
And the less said about what happened to some of the individuals after this race, the better.
Oh, yeah. Privately, I've spoken about what had happened to Albert Lemaitre, who you can go, read about. Comte de Don, he also has a very controversial, future at this point, which his rivalry with the newspaper editor just escalates to national proportions, where it's front page news that he openly hates his newspaper editor, and they ended up in massive political squabbles, which Daydon actually ended up in jail for 2 weeks for physically assaulting the president of France at a Parisian horse track.
And somehow this wasn't the worst case of bodily harm on the podium.
Yes. I rather not say. You could read into it. Though I will give
yeah,
you...
it's bad. It's bad.
It's real bad. Next year, in terms of... Next year, it's almost a repeat of what happens this year, of where the fastest car on the road again doesn't win. And that was the spark of Daydon just being fucking done. And founding, he didn't lose next year. The next year, he didn't even enter. That's how done he was. But actually, no, he did enter, but he did not qualify. He himself didn't qualify, but his teammate ended up qualifying, failed to finish. Panhard had won the next year at the Paris-Bordeaux-Paris, their car ended up being disqualified for a very similar reason this year, but not as dumb. They're all gas-powered cars the next year, but Peugeot ended up getting handed the win again.
Fantastic. And that all, in all of its late 19th century silliness, was the inaugural Paris-Rouen Le Petit Journal Horseless Carriages Challenge. I couldn't get a chance to watch the race on television on the fact that the medium was not invented for another 75 years at least, well before broadcast rights to motorsport were even a thing, let alone organized motorsport in general. But from the Disruption King, I think I would certainly give this a 9 coal powered shovelers out of 10.
Yes, it is definitely up there. Not the perfect start to an entire sport, but it was good enough that people wanted more.
Mercedes, you bastard, stop trying to spoil the finish.
Just let us have our one moment.
You're already quicker than most people in your field and everything else.
You lock out the podium 125 years ago and you still gotta flex.
Oh, goodness. Well, with that said, let's fast forward a little bit to the present day. And after this quick musical interlude, we'll be back to discuss the IndyCar Iowa 300 at Iowa Speedway.
Joseph! Twister, little bugger.
Simon! Simon, where are you, my French little friend? Simon! Simon! Where are you?
American boy! My French friend, where are you?
Chris, what have you done? You brought all this rain to Iowa. You made us all stay up late. And now we're officially in IndyCar After Dark territory.
Oh, it was coming down hard, everybody. I can tell you that right now.
The track was so damp, they had to dry all the vapors off the surface.
Drill holes in the surface and suck out the water.
God. Takuma Sato had himself 2 dinners and a nap. The other best story from the extended IndyCar radio pre-race show. Iowa 300, everybody. We got it in on the scheduled day. It was much later because this was supposed to be a dusk to nighttime finish, but because of the weather delays, it started in full darkness, did it not, Chris?
Completely dark. It was started just after 10:45 at night. It should have started at night anyway, which was the comment that several drivers made, but can't pick and choose this one, can we?
No, but that it did ultimately work out for everyone better on. The official start of the race was delayed 4.5 hours due to lightning and heavy rain. A lot of us thought you're not gonna get this race in. Surely not. But finally, at 11:45 PM Eastern time, we got the race going again. And then not even a half hour later, we had another shower and a red flag.
Like, it at that point, I had to be at work the next morning, so I literally gave up and went to sleep.
I remember passing out just before the start of the race and waking up to the final restart after the third and final caution. I remember just being awake enough to listen to the finish. And then just feeling like, awesome. Now back to bed. I was not conscious enough for this. I couldn't imagine like being at the event itself through all these delays and just thinking like, are we going to have to come back tomorrow? When are we going to start the race tomorrow if we have to do this? Are we going to get this all in tonight? But it turned out to be a really, really damn good race. Iowa Speedway is a fantastic little short track, especially made for cars like this. There's plenty of side-by-side action, and the racing is always good. And it can also lead to some pretty dominant drives. Enter one Joseph Newgarden, who again, in 2016, won this race with a broken freaking hand and collarbone.
Yeah, we could just go back, listen to the previous episode. At the end, we said, hey, Newgarden's really good here.
Turns out, he's still good. He led 245 laps and took his fourth win of the season and extended his points lead. Fun fact, this is the fourth time in 5 years that Newgarden has led the most laps. Because, if you'll recall, last year, he led 229 out of the 300 laps, but only finished in fourth. But this time, he closed out the deal.
Yeah, Joseph Newgarden has had a very, very good time here at Iowa Speedway. Had a couple of seconds a few years ago, but last year, he lost out to James Hinchcliffe late in the going and pitted underneath the final caution. This year, they sealed the deal and really did a fantastic job. Really, the biggest story for me, though, was the points battle because, he finished fourth at Toronto and lost ground to Alexander Rossi. Now he's gained to where he's got a 29-point lead in the championship. Newgarden's got it going on. Coming up to Mid-Ohio, he's won there. Coming up to Gateway, he's won there too. Pocono, second. He's got some good momentum coming up, but I'll tell you what, it was actually entertaining to see him drive the way he did, knowing that his championship is at stake here.
I believe as well. He also said he was feeling upset after Friday qualifying because he had to see Simon Pagenaud take pole position right from underneath of him. Even though he knew he had a quick car, he was just determined to get out there and show that he had a quick car during the race.
Him and Power were both visibly exacerbated. In fact, Power even raised his hands up, asking for divine intervention for the race. And divine intervention came, but it surely didn't benefit him in the race. And we'll talk about that later.
Right. That's Newgarden's fourth win of the season, and it extends out his championship lead. We'll get into that. It's also the 14th victory in his career, and the race finished at 2:14 a.m. Eastern time.
Man,
I didn't get to bed until 4:15 in the morning, actually, Central Time.
Oh my God.
Yeah, you were probably seeing, the sun starting to rise.
I was seeing stars, all right.
And I know because of the weather delays, it wasn't necessarily the largest crowd on hand for an IndyCar oval race, but the fans who stuck around all the way to the bitter end, y'all are the real MVPs, honestly.
Yeah. Anytime, my favorite races on the IndyCar calendar are always short ovals. Milwaukee used to be my favorite, Iowa's my favorite now, and anytime there are talks about, hey, we should go back to X Short Oval, it's like the main argument's like, oh, will the fans show up? And man, in Iowa, they definitely showed up. And despite the delays, you know, there were passionate fans there willing to wait it out to see the race.
Shout outs as well to the UK crew. where the race ended closer to 8 a.m. I remember getting tweets from friend of the show, Zoe Hamilton, who was watching the race until the sun came up in Scotland as she was figuring out how to mix different brands of pink sparkling gin. Oh my God. I don't blame Dre at all one bit for just checking out early on this one. But man, if you were able to stay up this late, you gotta see a dominant drive, and just behind him, you got to see yet another incredible where did he come from Scott Dixon comeback drive.
That's what he does best.
I'd just like to point out that Scott Dixon, for most of this race, was a lap down and at risk of going two laps down. But he and Mike Hull kept plugging at it, and thanks to a late decision to switch on to new tires for the final stint, Scott Dixon clawed his way all the way back to a second-place finish. In a race he had no business even being up in the top five to begin with! Chris, how does he do this?
Kevin Harvick once said he had a golden horseshoe stuck up his ass, so I don't know, it might be the same thing for Scott, but the thing with Scott was that he was... you know, waiting to make his last pit stop, and it just so happened right after I tweeted that Scott Dixon would benefit from a yellow, Ed Carpenter spins, exiting turn two, hits the wall with the right side of the car, and Scott Dixon pits under yellow because, of course, that's what you do at Iowa with 30 laps to go.
Yeah, that fresh rubber really helped him make up ground. He had a bit of a fight with James Hinchcliffe for second place in the end. Hinchcliffe doing well despite, you know, nearly giving Alexander Rossi food poisoning on accident during an impromptu barbecue session.
Quote unquote accident.
Yeah, I remember listening back to that, and Hinch, and they mentioned, like, you know, Rossi said you served him some undercooked chicken, and Hinch was just like, oh yeah, that was actually what I meant to feed him. You know, I'm hoping by about lap 150 in the race that his stomach starts to turn, he starts to feel a little uncomfortable. Yeah, that's going to be our strategy. But yes, Scott Dixon, coming back from a lap down to finish in second, another incredible comeback drive, and one that certainly keeps his championship hopes alive. Also, fun stat from an IndyCar post-race report, in 316 starts in his career, Scott Dixon has finished first or second 90 times. That's 28.5%.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
He has as many wins as he does second place finishes.
He can't be stopped. He can't be stopped.
He still has reasonably four or five more elite level years in the sport.
He's going to have more than that. His wife's pregnant again.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Oh, I see.
So he's got to keep racing to go support another kid.
That's true. These pancakes aren't going to cook themselves. We mentioned some of the other title contenders. Simon Pagenaud took pole position with a blistering time on Friday when it was still daytime out, the sun was out, and it was hot. Now, obviously, with the much cooler conditions at the nighttime, Pagenaud's car didn't seem to react too well to the change in conditions. While he finished a respectable fourth, it wasn't what it could have been given his qualifying performance.
Yeah, it seemed like...
For Pagenaud, you know, he'd been riding this humongous wave of momentum, and the last two races that he started on pole from, he won. And, I mean, going into the weekend, I was thinking, yeah, if he wins a pole, he's going to win. But, I mean, he won at Phoenix a couple years ago. That was his first ever oval win. I was thinking, well, he knows how to win on a short oval. Why not win here? Fortunately, it just didn't happen.
Yeah, I think that was like a consequence of the rain delay, where it's like less of the track not being as rubbered in as it could be, more of just, you know, just sitting there waiting, the track just bleeding off heat as, you know, the night goes on.
The Weepers.
The Weepers.
Yeah, he led only the first lap, and then he led only the first two laps, and then just dropped from there and was never a factor for the victory after that point. It was also a surprisingly subpar day at the office for Alexander Rossi, who only came away with a sixth-place finish. Yes, it does keep him within 29 points of the lead, but given Andretti Autosport's previous track record of this event, you kind of feel like maybe more could have been expected out of him. Yeah, he just didn't have the car underneath of him. As we're going through the finishing order, there were seven cars that finished on the lead lap, and two of them tied or made their best finishes of the season. Spencer Pigot from 19th to finish 5th, and Zach Veach from 20th to finish 7th. Great job for both these young men.
Yeah, they were tremendous out on track. I ended up watching the 30-minute fast-forward, and man, Veach was very confident out there.
Yeah, confident as you could be, because Chris, he didn't necessarily think that he was going to be starting this race because
I must have missed that.
Yeah, his fuel tank started to leak out, I believe, so they had to take the car back to the garage before wheeling it out before the start.
That must have been when I was stuck in my car waiting for the rain to come down. I didn't have I couldn't get cell phones, I couldn't get internet access or anything. So I was completely in the dark for that time.
Oh no, yeah. Something was up with Veach's fuel tank. They had to wheel the car back in the pits, and considering how many times Zach Veach has caught on fire inadvertently at times of season, you know, I think that was for the best. And ultimately they did get the car in working condition for him to finish 7th, his best result of the season. Hey, good for him. He is on his way to breaking what's been a tough sophomore season in that number 26 car.
It was good to see Veach get this kind of momentum, especially when you look at the fact that the next race is his home race in Mid-Ohio. He just hasn't had a good year this year. I mean, last year he did well at Long Beach. He did pretty well in the last half of the year, but I mean, this year just has not been for him. So I'm happy to see him do well this time around. Happy to see that.
Yes, and Spencer Pigot as well. He's starting to like Iowa Speedway because in his two visits, he was second last year and he was 5th this year. And I know at Carpenter Racing, they build quick cars around Iowa Speedway, but Spencer is really taking a liking to this track, I must say. And I've got to feel like that first win is going to be coming sooner rather than later. There were a number of cars and a number of drivers that found themselves in the wars. Unfortunately, among them, Will Power was running up near the front, but he was tagged with a drive-through penalty for an improper pin entry that knocked him down to the tail end of one lap down. He finished in 15th, and Takuma Sato was running up in the top 5, but not even having two dinners and a nap was going to save him from tripping over Sage Karam's car. Sage jacked up. Sato run in the back of him. That spins him at a lap around lap 168. He retires after 216
laps. Actually, you have that in reverse.
Oh, yeah. So it was Karam who tripped over Sato after Sato checked up. I remember
correct.
Now. I see. Yeah.
Well, their car numbers 30 and 31, so.
Yeah, they just look a little different. Oh, man. That's a bummer for Sato. He was having such a good race, and that really does put another hammer blow to his title hopes, because a top 5 finish would have gone a long way to help him keep pace with the likes of Newgarden and Pagenaud and Rossi and Ditson up in front of him. Same for Power as well. With that 15th place finish, he drops further and further away from Newgarden's lead.
Yeah, so Power is now 165 points down with 5 races to go. And I asked him after the race is done, you know, is this... how much harder does it make your championship chance? He said, dude, it's damn near impossible now. He's just going to try and, try and win every race that he can from here on out. I think we're going to see, I don't want to say a desperate willpower, but a willpower that really has nothing left to lose for this year, you know, try and drive his butt off to try and win here. He won at Pocono. Believe he did win at Gateway last year. You know, he's had victory snatched from him twice at Mid-Ohio over the last few years. So I think we're going to see a change in willpower for the rest of the year. Sato was only 11 points behind him. Hunter Ray, you know, sitting on 298.
Talk about a guy as well. Hunter Ray only finishing 17th, a man who loves this track and has had so much success here.
Yeah, he's got two wins here, and he's another guy that hasn't had much luck recently. He's had three straight finishes outside the top 10. I don't know what's going on with him, or really everybody else at Andretti except for Alexander Rossi. You look at the rest of Andretti Autosport. We talked about Zach Veach earlier, but Marco Andretti, he was called to pit road for being basically too slow.
Oh, 95 laps down, retired after 205 for what is officially listed as handling problems.
I don't know what's going on with that. I mean, like really, like with as good as Andretti Autosport's been, I don't know what's going on with Marco this year. I mean, Iowa, it's the place where he got his last win. He's done well there before in the past. I just don't know what's been going on with him this year. It's like in the last three races, he retired at Road America, 10th at Toronto, and, you know, 21st at Iowa. I'm hoping he gets another top 10, because if you look at the roller coaster, it's time to go up.
Excellent. Yeah, that's, And of course, shout out to IndyCar as well. They had actually uploaded that 2011 Iowa 300 race. It was a fantastic drive. And of course, great to hear the late, great Dan Weldon on commentary as well for that event. It was a good race, especially if you were hardy enough to stay up through the whole thing. Here is the rundown of the finishing order. Again, Joseph Newgarden winning the race, 245 laps led, and a margin of victory of 2.8 seconds over Scott Dixon in second. James Hinchcliffe finishing third. Pole sitter Simon Paginot dropping to fourth place. Spencer Pigot in 15th, up from 19th on the grid, improved 14 places. Alexander Rossi finishes where he started in sixth. Zach Veach, the last of the lead lap finishers, moving up 13 spots to finish seventh. Graham Rahal was first off the lead lap in eight. Sebastian Bourdais moved up 12 spots. A very good drive for Bourdais, going from 21st to finish ninth. Tony Kanaan with a top 10 finish in 10th. Two rookies in 11th and 12th. Marcus Ericsson, who really likes this track, in 11th. And Santino Ferrucci, who got a mammoth start at the finish. Oh, man, what a good start. I hate saying it,
both, but that was rookies, such a good start. I want to talk about both rookies here real quick. Ericsson really, really enjoyed this close action at Iowa Speedway. He really enjoyed, you know, being able to pass and repass other cars. And I drew the comparison. It's basically the closest thing that an oval track is to a street circuit, because here, you know, it's elbows out. It's really tight confines. You've got to really, you know, muscle yourself around people. And Ferrucci had some amazing moves, you know, going around people on restarts and actually fighting Alexander Rossi for a top five spot early on in the race. You know, not bad for the driver that calls Sebastian Bourdais dad when dad has his 200th start.
Christ. Oh my goodness. Yeah, Marcus was driving the oval like a road course, and he seems like he's having a lot more fun here than in the last years of his F1 career, especially in that time at K-Room. The less said about that, the better. Connor Daly finishing a strong 13th. He qualified 16th. It looks like he's getting that Carlin team turned around just a little bit.
Yeah, when you look at where Connor started, he started, I think, it was like 16th. He was running mid-pack the whole way through, and he could have gotten 11th or 12th, but you got to sometimes take what you can get. He hasn't actually done really well at Iowa Speedway, too, in the last couple of years. So it was good to see him, you know, complete the race just one lap down. And a race for Carlin that, you know, some people may have seen it as, oh, it's just going to be a throwaway because you've got two drivers in the team that have never worked together before. How well are they going to do? But both drivers have won on the road at Iowa Speedway, on the road to Indy as well.
Yes, let's see here. Felix Rosenquist out here confusing everybody with himself and Scott Dixon finishing in 14th. Will Powers mentioned in 15th. Matthias Leist, 16th, two laps down ahead of Ryan Hunter Ray in 17th. There were only five retirements. Colton Herta broke down after lap 276. Ed Carpenter, as mentioned, spun and tagged the wall with 38 to go. Takuma Sato had that run-in with Sage Karam. He retired after 216 laps. Marco Andretti officially retired after 205 with a handling problem. And as mentioned, Sage Karam, his second race back with Carlin, was just in the wars all day and classified 22nd and last after starting 14th.
It wasn't an ideal race for Karam. I have to say this with the whole Colton Herta situation. He came into this race looking really, really nice. You know, his car handled well. Everything looked, you know, like it was on form for him. I hesitate to say I credit that with cutting his hair, but I don't know, maybe.
Oh, God. Colton cut his hair. I forgot. And, of course, I love the tweet that he made during the rain delay. And it was just like, guys, I appreciate you being concerned about my bedtime, but Dad said I could stay up all night and even hang out with my friend overnight. Dad, George Steinbrenner the IV. Oh, this is so good. Next up, of course, we have Mid-Ohio, where we have had 6 different winners in the last 6 years. But if history is any indicator, you may look to the likes of Scott Dixon and Alexander Rossi, who have excelled here in recent years, and especially historically in the case of Dixon, who always does well at Mid-Ohio, seemingly.
Yeah, Dixon's won here 5 times, but he hasn't won here since 2014. He started working with Chris Simmons, his current engineer, in 2015, so they're looking for their first win together at the track. That pretty much was Dixon's personal playground for a few years there. But if last year's anything to go by, I don't see how I can pick against Rossi. Then again, I haven't picked against Rossi in a few races now, so I don't know. Is it just because he's that damn good, or is it just because he's the most entertaining driver to watch in American racing today? Probably both. Why not?
Sums it up succinctly. Again, just to recap the championship standings, Joseph Newgarden, with 487 points, now has a 29-point lead over Alexander Rossi in second. Simon Pagenaud, third on 429 points, and it's another 40 points back to Scott Dixon in fourth, coming off of 3 straight top 5 finishes. Will Power slides to 5th on 322 points. He's 11 points ahead of Takuma Sato and sits on 311. Ryan Hunter-Reay, the best of the rest, in 7th on 298, just 8 points ahead of Graham Ray Hall on 290. Then another 11 points back to James Hinchcliffe in 9th place. Sebastian Bourdais and Felix Rosenquist, your leading rookie in the race, tied each at 255 points, with 5 races remaining, including the double points finale at Laguna Seca. Oh, baby, this is gonna get good. We are down to effectively 4 realistic title contenders, and we've got a good variety of races coming up. It's gonna be awesome.
I was gonna say, you know, road course, super speedway, short oval, road course. We just got out of a short oval, and the one before that was a street circuit. How much more diverse can you get in motorsports than this? Is there any wonder why I think IndyCar is probably the best championship going right now?
Yeah, that's a very fair point. And it's, of course, it's so densely packed. If we're going to have a race next week, they just keep cramming it in there.
Yep, July is packed for IndyCar. And it feels like a lot like differently than F1, where when you get to the end of the season, you know there are not a lot of back to backs. You know the season kind of starts to stretch out, but no, when IndyCar gets closer to the finale, the number of races just start ramping up.
This was the second in 3 consecutive weeks with IndyCar races, and then after that, we'll have 3 straight weeks where we go to Pocono, Gateway, and Portland. Excuse me, Pocono Worldwide Technology Raceway, Gateway, and Portland. Before we eventually get to Firestone Grand Prix of Monterey on September 22nd.
You mean Worldwide Technology Raceway with the SLAP sponsorship fund?
Oh, yes, with LAP 101, sponsored by Motorsport 101. Oh, man. There was, of course, some other racing that happened. We'll take a short break and get into some of that, as well as the rest of the news that is fit to record. Right after this. King W series happened. Not once, but twice. In Essen.
Yeah, double DTM. Dutching.
Yes. DTM also happened. Marco Wittmann and Mike Rockenfeller won races. But we've taken a liking to the W series. We were skeptical at first with the idea worked, but, you know, the racing is damn good. And it's especially awesome to see people get a chance to succeed, such as Emma Kumalainen, who has had a very, very rough season in 2019, has she not?
Yes, away with injuries. She's been cleared to return. She's fit to return. And, oh, she definitely
ever fit to return? Emma Kumalainen from seemingly nowhere wins from pole position in the fourth round of the championship at the TT Circuit Assen. You know, you could say it's weird to see cars at Assen, the traditional bike track, but I'll tell you, and especially when we get to the next race we're going to talk about, I'd say it's perfectly fine to have cars at Assen.
Ooh, it is perfectly fine, and man, heading into the weekend, Kumalainen said that she felt that this would be a venue that would suit her, and oh, she certainly showed that she was very fast around the track, very, you know, commanding position out front, made the best of it, didn't make any mistakes, brought home the victory.
If I'm not mistaken, did she complete the Grand Slam out of this, too? Because I know she won from pole position, set the fastest lap. Did she lead every lap of this race?
I'm not sure, because I only watched the highlights for race one.
That does sound about right. It's at least a hat trick and a dominant drive for Emma Kumalainen, who I know has been waiting and hoping to get back into this car for so long since her injuries put her on the shelf. You have to wonder, if not for that injury, we probably would have seen her up in title contention.
Well, it's already been confirmed that if she has pretty much all the rights to come back next year, because they have confirmed that if you finish in the top 12 in the championship, you're automatically qualified to participate next year.
And that's it, and that is very good. As we mentioned, we have a title race on the line here, and it looks like this has narrowed it down to two realistic contenders. Your girl Jamie Chadwick and Bietzka Visser, who finished together on the road by just 6 tenths of a second. Chadwick in third and Visser in fourth, with Alice Powell completing the podium in second. Great to see her finally lock one up after so many good drives, but just not enough luck.
Yeah, it's always great to see, you know, these drivers that we didn't get to see race very often before now, make a name for themselves, put out good performances, because, yes, we might see, you know, frequently we see Visser and Chadwick up front, but usually someone could put in a good performance and show that they're worth something.
Indeed. On the other hand, some other aspiring title contenders did take fatal blows to their championship hopes. Marta Garcia only finishing in ninth after that win at the Norris Ring, so she drops out of title contention. And Fabian Volwind was the last driver to finish on the lead lap in 15th. There were only two retirements. Mickey Koyama and Tasman Pepper both got involved in a first lap accident, so they were the only two out in the championship race. So again, that's Kumalainen. A great victory, well-deserved, ahead of Alice Powell in second, Jamie Chadwick third, Bietzka Visser fourth, Kate Wood in fifth, Goja Rabest in sixth, Jessica Hawk in seventh, Vicky Peria eighth, Marta Garcia ninth, and Sarah Moore in rounding out the top 10. That was the championship race. Let's talk about this non-championship race, Kate.
Ooh, the Jamie Chadwick Disinvitational. Man, a reverse grid race, with the grid being, you know, lined up in reverse championship order. A lot of people came in with an open mind. They're like, we're not sure if it's going to be work out to be fantastic, but I'm just going to sit back, see what happens, and we got a lot of action out of it.
Yeah, and again, this was announced with weeks to go before the race actually got going. So, with the inverted championship order, was Megan Gilkes and Sarah Bovey starting on the front row of the grid. As mentioned, Jamie Chadwick would start back in 20th because she was the championship leader.
And there might not have been any points on the line. The drivers had a lot to lose if they were too aggressive, because the cars that they were driving in would be the cars that they'd be driving at the championship finale at Brands Hatch.
And that is coming up just around the corner, too. That's like, that's in August. This season's almost already over.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. And this Jamie Chadwick, this Invitational Classic, treated us to a fantastic finish, King.
Oh, God. It's been a while. Well, I say since Monaco, probably, since I've seen a single-seater race not on an oval end this close.
Oh, my goodness. In the end, Alice Powell was the woman on a charge. She started 17th. And had made her way all the way to the back of Megan Gilkey's gearbox. And it came down to a final lap, final quarter sprint. Powell thought she had it over the line, but in the end, Megan Gilkey's, by 0.01 of a second, takes the victory in the non-championship Jamie Chadwick Disinvitational Classic.
And she might have won from pole, but it was certainly not an easy win from pole in a race set.
Oh, no.
In a race that included two safety car restarts. She held on to the lead the whole way.
Yes, and shout-outs as well to America's own Sabra Cook, finishing with the fastest lap and rounding off the podium just 0.3 off the win.
And I mean, Sabre had a tremendous start. She, for a second at the start, I was like, did she jump the start? Because the way her car took off compared to everyone else's, I was worried.
Yes, bike racing would know all about jump starts. And what is a jump start?
Yes.
Oh man, this was so much fun. If you haven't already, go out of your way to watch this W Series race. When you are able to, this non-championship race, it's something really awesome.
Yeah, it's not geo-blocked. It's all available, the entire race, on YouTube.
Kevin Harvick won the NASCAR Cup Series race at New Hampshire, which means you get to recite the famous chant for free onion rings. Jimmy, Jimmy, help me, please. Please drop the onion fees. And also IMSA at Lime Rock Park happened. Ford won in a titanic battle with Porsche for the overall victory, and afterwards Ben Keating got into a Twitter beef with Catherine Legg.
Just normal IMSA things.
Just normal IMSA things from the company that brought you the Andy Lally Sage Karam fight in the Waffle House special. Oh, and also Corvette Racing were absolutely nowhere thanks to BOP changes after Watkins Glen.
Thanks, BOP.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Just imagine if these were coal-powered Corvettes.
They'd dominate, right?
And boomers would still like them more than the C8.
It's a mid-engine car. It looks like a Ferrari. It looks fine. It looks fine. It may not sound as good, but it's great. It's a good car.
I'm not thinking of a coleslaw-powered race car, Chris. We're not having this discussion on a recorded episode.
That is for the server and the server only.
I'm leaving this in. Chris, we have a new face on the IndyCar grid, but it's an old face and a familiar one, and I believe you want to bet.
So, RC Anderson, he's got an interesting history. He drove in USF 2000 for a few years. He drove in Indy Lights for 2015, and he's part of 2016, and then he drove at Mid-Ohio and a couple of other races in 2016. Hasn't been in the car for a while, but he's been keeping fit and keeping in shape, and he's going to have another shot to race here coming up at Mid-Ohio with Carlin in the number 31 car. His family's business is the Lucas Oil School of Racing, and they will be the primary sponsors for the number 31 car this coming weekend. Mid-Ohio is a bit of an interesting track for RC. He was leading the 2014 USF 2000 Points Championship when, unfortunately, he and Victor Franzoni got together, and that kind of started the downfall of his championship run that year. Didn't win the title. In 2015, I want to say it was, he actually won an Indy Lights race at the track, so he knows his way around Mid-Ohio, and it should be a good showing for him and Carlin. And also, let's not forget, Carlin got their first ever Firestone Fast 6 appearance at Mid-Ohio.
Indeed, and for Enerson, you know, he only driven three IndyCar races at the end of 2016 with Coyne. I can tell you, he looked quick in all of them. And again, he's been out of action for a little while. He's still only 22 years old. I'll be interested to see how he performs in that number 31 car as well. Formula E silly season kicked off. We don't even get a week outside of the season, and already the bombshell drops that Champ Car World Series alum and three-time Le Mans winner and Super Formula and Super GT champion Andre Lotterer is leaving Tachita and going to Porsche. Open the floodgates begin the speculation.
Oh, everyone send your CVs to Tachita. Hey, maybe you'll get to be Jean-Eric Vergne's teammate next year.
Oh, and there is one interesting rumor that I have heard, and it ties into some recent Formula One silly season rumors. So apparently the word in the garage is that Romain Grosjean is effectively driving for his F1 career this weekend at Germany, which we'll get into a bit. I think he'll see out the season, but there's talk that Grosjean may be linked to a switch to Formula E to take that second seat at Tachita. And honestly, the more I think about it, the more I think it would actually be a good fit, and here's why. Because Grosjean is starting to stagnate, and he's starting to press way too hard. Haas, on the other hand, they are also starting to stagnate. This is a partnership that is no longer beneficial, and Grosjean has not been in a situation where he can win a race since 2013, where he probably should have won that Japanese Grand Prix if he had gotten undercut by those Red Bulls. The trade-off would, of course, be that Esteban Ocon would take over his place at Haas. I mean, you know, there's a lot of open candidates. Could you see Romain Grosjean working out with this team in season six?
Yes, Grosjean would be a fantastic get for the team. Though the rumors, well, before the whole Grosjean driving for his career thing came up, the most popular rumor that I have heard so far that the second seat would probably end up going to current Tachita test driver James Rossiter.
Another Super Formula and Super GT alum, passing the torch from the one to the other. I'd heard Antonio Felix da Costa's name floated about, but I don't see it because he's still pretty solid with BMW, is he not?
Yes, and BMW looks very competitive.
I mean, hell, for all we know, Ty Dillon could end up in this seat in 2020.
Oh my god, no.
Better than Austin Dillon, and better than that one picture of Austin Dillon.
I would sneak beers into the track just so I could throw it on the track.
Yeah, and again, if Tachita can just, you know, not trip over each other, that would be great. We also got some reports from the Spanish press that we're going to have a major move in the design portion of Formula One. Because it looks like Aldo Costa is going to leave Mercedes at the end of this year, and apparently he's going to be moving back home to Ferrari.
Ooh, man. Part of me is like, why? Why, though?
Oh, Ferrari might need all the help they can get. Again, Aldo Costa has been instrumental in designing Mercedes' incredible cars, including their new throwback livery, that they are set to reveal in bits and pieces leading up to the German Grand Prix, you know, for that Paris to Rouen thing and the 125th anniversary of motor racing that we talked about.
Though, if I had to hedge my bets, their throwback livery seems to be partially a nod back to their first quote-unquote Grand Prix car. It was not a Grand Prix car. That thing was a massive tank. The Mercedes SSK.
But not like an actual massive
tank. No, it was not an actual tank.
It was not a Formula truck, which I'm kicking myself that I did not watch the Formula truck race on this, the official podcast of the Formula truck series.
So, yeah, it seems like it is either a nod to their SSK, which actually won Grand Prix despite being like almost, well, looking in pictures twice the size of the Bugattis at the time. One Grand Prix, you know, in the hands of Rudy Caracciola in the late 20s, early 30s.
He calls him Rudy.
Hey.
Now, there's a Rudy whose accomplishments weren't embellished for the silver screen.
Yes. That thing was a massive tank. It raced at Monaco, and people were like, how is this possible? How can something this large race at Monaco, not knowing, you know, how big F1 cars nowadays would be? And also, it seems like it could also be a nod back to the Mercedes GP 1914, which won the last Grand Prix before World War I, which happened before the war started, but after Franz Ferdinand had gotten assassinated. Weird time, but they ran the French Grand Prix still, and that car won the race.
And of course, with them bringing out their W10B upgrade package, they're going to put on a vintage throwback to earlier this spring by leveling the field in Germany. Now the only question is who's going to finish third. We have other racing that's going to happen, of course. We have the aforementioned IndyCar Mid-Ohio. Ditson seems to be a favorite. Rossi seems to be a favorite. And hey, it's in Ohio. Ain't much happening going on in Ohio. Certainly not good basketball.
Yeah, just, you know, maybe something great could come back to Cleveland that's not LeBron.
You got Odell Beckham Jr. What are you talking about?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Football was much better. Also, I'm sorry for your loss, King. Oh, no, wait, that's the wrong New York team.
Yeah, wrong New York. I'm glad. I mean, excellent. The Jets are still a dumpster fire, but at least the Giants get
to be bad with
us.
But you're a dumpster fire with Le'Veon Bell and slick new uniforms. Speaking of slick new uniforms, that was a segue into Bentley's wonderful throwback cars that are going to be running at the total 24 hours of Spa-Francorchamps. We are having an endurance racing packed weekend because it's not only this, but it's also the only race on the Endurance World Championship of Motorcycle Racing calendar that if you're going to watch one, it's going to be this one. It's the Coca-Cola Suzuka 8 Hours, the all-star race of superbike racing, complete with Kawasaki fielding Jonathan Rea in one of their bikes, Yamaha going for 5 victories in a row, and Honda going for their 28th win at the event on the track in which they own. That both of these are going to be a good time. Be sure to brew plenty of coffee and keep some
all the coffee, please.
And surprise to those fans who may be watching and wondering and thinking, like, wait, Honda's not terrible. As it turns out, the endurance bikes are to a much different spec than they are in World Superbikes.
Yeah, I assume they have larger tanks and are probably heavier because they need to have the mechanisms required to refuel.
But yes, it's going to be Katsuyuki Nagasuka, outs lose, and a hopefully healthy and fit Michael Vandermark trying for Yamaha's 5th straight win in the event. But it's been the Red Bull Hondas who have been quick all throughout testing with Takumi Takahashi, Ryuichi Kirinari, and Stefan Bradl as part of that team. That ought to be good. The Spa-Francorchamps, by the way, has 72 cars on the entry list.
Oof. That's going to be a big one.
that is going to be a big one. You've got that. You've got some good short form racing in the German Grand Prix and the Grand Prix of Mid-Ohio. That is what to look forward to this weekend. King, Chris, have I missed anything important to wrap things up?
Ooh, well, we do have certain endurance-related news where it seems like Formula E and the WEC have come to one agreement to get next year's 6 hours of Spa moved so it won't clash with the Soli Prix.
And it won't clash with the Fuji 500 kilometers, which means Kaz can be there. Oh my God, that was always, that's one of the most annoying pain points about that scheduling clash, and thank God they had that fixed.
Yeah, they got that fixed. They're working on resolving at least one of the other clashes where one of the TBC rounds seeming more like it's the round with Sanya looked like it was going to clash with a WEC round earlier in the season, but they're getting that move so that won't clash. Though the clash with the second round of the season, which is looking like it's probably going to be Marrakesh and Jakarta, won't make the calendar.
I'm sorry, Resi.
Yeah, well, it seems like that probably won't be resolved, so there might be one clash on the calendar.
Mm-hmm. I see. Oh, man. Well,
we also have the Road to Indy at Mid-Ohio. And,
yes.
Good news for all of the Wisconsinites. Aaron Telus is back with Bilardi Auto Racing.
Woo! Yes, coming off that strong drive at Toronto. Of course, that epic title fight that's brewing between Oliver Askew and Rinus VK. That is something to look forward to as well.
Yeah, I think Oliver, quite frankly, is going to take it. Rinus, he has a test coming up with EC Ed Carpenter Racing, so that should be fun to see. It's going to be interesting to see how his feedback, is taken at that test. I'm thinking Oliver should get a test pretty soon, hopefully anyway, but, you know, I don't know what his plans are. Hopefully it's at Mid-Ohio because he did pretty well there a couple years ago in USF 2000 competition, but we'll see.
I see. And with that, this wraps up this episode of Motorsport 101. And no bad weather has come our way. I've got my eye on you, Chris. I've got my eye on you because I know your powers are becoming dangerously high at this point.
Let's see, the lottery numbers are...
Places you can find us one more time. We're on youtube.com/motorsport101, facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter at motorsport_101. If you wish to follow us personally, you can at Harrison101HD, at Ryan Eric King, at RJ O'Connell, and at C. DeHardy. And of course, your financial support at patreon.com/motorsport101 helps make this show possible. $5 gets you early access to all of our shows. $10, you get in the supporter section of our Patreon, the supporter section of our Discord, and listen to these shows live as they come out. Special thanks as well to Cam, to Toki, and to Vincent. Hello, dear, for listening in. You all are the real MVPs as we have gone through a journey over 125 years from Paris all the way to Iowa and all corners of the world. Thank you so much for listening. Everything Motorsport 101 you can find on motorsport101.com. Before all of New York City ends up underwater, it's time we bid you adieu. For Andre Harrison, Chris DeHardy, and for Ryan Eric King, I'm RJ O'Connell, saying so long and thank you very much for listening. Later, y'all!
Bye!
See you.